Thank you very much, Dr. McClellan. Our final speaker is Dr. William Kimball, who received his Bachelor of Arts degree at DePaul University in 1960 and his PhD at the University of Virginia. He is a specialist in the history of economics with particular focus on Adam Smith, the subject of his dissertation. He's published in the American Economic Review, the Journal of Economic Issues, the Intercollegiate Review, and other journals. His topic this morning is the spirit of the Founding Fathers. Dr. Kimball.
Thank you. The purpose of this paper is to examine the following question. Will a recreation of the spirit of the Founding Fathers be of help to us in the 20th century? Note that the question is not, would the spirit of the Founding Fathers be better than the mindless hedonism and vulgarized envy of modern democracy? Of that, there is no doubt. But whether the spirit of the Founding Fathers will be helpful to us is subject to grave doubts. I would argue that this is so because the Founding Fathers of our nation, as well as the Founding Father of my discipline, economics, are grounded in the new science of politics, which in turn is based upon a view of self-love inadequately based on the truth of reality. The only social science which I think would be adequate to our times, or for that matter any other times, is one grounded in a proper theory of self-love rather than self-interest. Love is not a sentimental surrender to emotion and feeling, but a steady and cool promotion of the true good of the object of one's love, whether oneself or others. It is true that the Founding Fathers and Adam Smith, in contrast to the relativism of modern social science, did believe that what they said was consistent with the nature of reality. The central question then becomes the nature of reality and the relation of man's experience to that reality. If one's understanding of experience and of men is grim, mean, low, and ungrateful, then the good for man, man's happiness, is going to be found in warding off evils and pursuing comfort. But let me hasten to add that a person's understanding of experience seems to have precious little to do with the content of that experience. So far as I know, there is no plausible environmental hypothesis to explain how a man feels about the world. Taking an ungrateful view of the world to its extreme leads to the Gnostic attempts to subvert reality with Satan and Prometheus as your comrades in arms. Less virulent forms lead to the typical right-wing and, or I might even say, economic ideologies, the absolutization of private property, emphasis on the will, that is, the sanctity of individual freedom, utility functions, calculi of consent, or as an economist might put it, you pay your money and takes your choice. It is very tempting to conservatives to remain on the side of the cynical and selfish. Economists, particularly in their day-to-day work of trying to understand people and what is going on in the marketplace, find it convenient and fruitful to take the low road. But I am more concerned with a more fundamental question. Are men and societies made happier by acting on such assumptions? Economists often find it difficult to conceive of any alternative because they are usually offered only one alternative. The altruism of a compte. Not only is this unrealistic, but it leads to a degrading and even more seductive collective worship. But is this the only alternative? In Federalist 29, Publius claims that in reading many of the publications against the Constitution, a man is apt to imagine that he is perusing some ill-written tale or romance, which instead of natural and agreeable images, exhibits to the mind nothing but frightful and distorted shapes, quote, Gorgons, hydras, and chimeras dire, end quote, discoloring and disfiguring whatever it represents and transforming everything it touches into a monster, end quote. No reference is given for the quote about Gorgons, hydras, and chimeras dire. The most likely reference that I can discover is Plato's Phaedrus. Here Plato is discussing the story of Boreas and Orotheria, and points out that both the allegorization of fables, and might we also add parables, and the rationalistic debunking of the same by scientific methods of criticism are a waste of time. The former means you will have to rehabilitate hippocentaurs and chimeras dire. Gorgons and winged steeds flow in apace, according to Socrates. The latter process, that of scientific debunking, is a sort of, quote, crude philosophy which takes up a great deal of time. Socrates declares that he has no leisure for such inquiries and proceeds to tell us why. Quote, I must first know myself, as the Delphian inscription says, to be curious about that which is not my concern while I'm still in ignorance of my own self would be ridiculous. And therefore I bid farewell to all this. The common opinion is enough for me. For as I was saying, I want to know about this, not about this, but about myself. Am I a monster more complicated and swollen with passion than Typho, or a creature of a gentler and simpler sort, possessing by divine grace a nature devoid of pride? End quote. If I may even go back a little earlier, we must not forget that Hesiod's Theogony discusses the meaning and the smashing of Typhoas, and that from Typhoas are descended the winds whose breath drives the rain, except Notus and Boreas, whom Socrates, of course, is discussing in the dialogue, and Zephyr, we always like Zephyr, who brings fair weather. These winds are descended from the gods, and to men they are a great blessing, end quote. Being from Louisiana, one has respect for the typhoon monster and its power to destroy simply as an element of nature. We call them hurricanes. Being a member of the human race, one also knows the power of human pride, swollen with passion. But here we touch upon the very essence of the so-called social sciences. What kind of creatures are we? What is our nature? Do we have the opportunity of changing that swollen, pride-ridden monster so that he becomes a creature of a gentler and simpler sort, possessing by divine grace a nature devoid of pride? It is around such elemental questions that the various versions of the founding seem to run. Is it too much to say that the whole split between Federalists and Anti-Federalists, ratifiers and anti-ratifiers, classical liberals versus conservatives, revolves around the answers to such a question? Let me try to unravel the confusion. But why should an economist concern himself with such matters? Modern economists pride themselves on their value-free, analytic rigorism, which in effect denatures man. For all practical purposes, most modern economists would assert that man has no nature, which is why we can treat him scientifically. Man, if anything, is a bundle of wants and desires. He is a utility function. We cannot say anything about the objects of those wants or desires, nor can we say anything about happiness. That development is another story, and it may be one that links up to our story, but it's not the same story. The classical economists and the founding fathers were not paralyzed by the fact-value distinction. On this matter, it is ironic that modern economists are often accused of assuming man to be selfish and a beast, when in the modern world it is more to the truth that economists have assumed man to be near angelic. Man's wants and desires are assumed to be good and worthy to be satisfied. Pride, envy, snobbery, malice, and lust have not been part of the modern economist's toolkit. When you draw an indifference curve, most often it is clothing and food, or X and Y, rather than pornographic AIDS and punk rock. Notice, Stan Evans, I did not include the popular music of the 50s. Now let us return to the world of Adam Smith and the Federalist Papers. The man to whom we are indebted for establishing the linkage between Adam Smith and the Federalist is, of course, the late Martin Diamond. Let me try to relate to the best of my very limited abilities, based on desultory forays into the political science literature, what I think is at stake here. First of all, Diamond, as well as Kendall. As a substantive end of equality. Or put otherwise, for Diamond, liberty is the end and democracy is the means. Second, democracy is a dangerous means which has never worked very well in the past. And therefore, having paid our due respect to the past, we must be prepared to be original and novel and experimental. Third, the experimental means, aside from a few gadgets, is owed to Adam Smith. An extended republic based on a widespread division of labor, economic progress leading to a commercial society, and a widespread difference of interests, both in degree and kinds of property, which defuses the majority faction, that is, the poor, so that they will not expropriate the rich. The new science of politics is essentially based on economics. Fourth, this development in turn is based on the triumph of modernity. The choice of practicable liberty rather than utopian virtue as the end of government. Let me quote Diamond's formulation. What was truly revolutionary in the American Revolution and its Declaration of Independence was that liberty, civil liberty, the doctrine of certain inalienable rights was made the end of government. Not has that been the case for millennia, whatever end power haphazardly imposed upon government, nor any longer the familiar variety of ends, not virtue, not piety, not privilege or wealth, not merely protection, and not empire and dominion, but now deliberately the principle of liberty. End quote. If this is correct, here is the green light for the economist. Character formation is replaced by institution building, as Diamond, citing Strauss, reminds us. Pride and vanity are to be channeled and not humbled. The dynamic energy of Typho is to be controlled to crank out the material goods. As Mandeville so clearly put it, so vice is beneficial found when it's by justice loped and bound. Vice is not to be eliminated, but it is to be used for utilitarian consequences. But is this the correct interpretation of the founding? A good, strong case can certainly be made for it. Let me put it in a very strong and perhaps perverse way. It can be argued that what economics and the political philosophy of the founding fathers is ultimately based on is the universalization of tyranny. If this sounds perversely paradoxical, let me note the meaning of tyranny according to Publius, which we've already been informed of this morning. In Federalist 47, Publius claims, quote, the accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary in the same hands, whether of one, a few, or many, and whether hereditary, self-appointed, or elective, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny, end quote. Now, let me point out that Kendall Carey, in their attempt to preserve justice from the envious maw of the egalitarians and modern liberals, point out in their conclusion that if, quote, we let them have their head, that is, the liberals, we shall speedily have the, quote, tyranny, end quote, that the Federalist teaches us how to avoid. Since Kendall Carey entitled their article, How to Read the Federalist Papers, and told us that we had an obligation to linger over every paragraph, which I cannot confess to have done every paragraph, I am not perhaps out of line in stressing the fact that their version of Federalist tyranny is in quotes, for the very good reason that it does not mean the same thing for the new science of politics as it did for the old science of politics. For the ancients, Publius's definition of tyranny fatally blurs the distinction between kingship and tyranny as the good and corrupt versions of one-man rule. It is precisely the definition of tyranny in terms of the mere accumulation of power that gives the rhetorical steam to the man versus the state dichotomy in the modern world. Aristotle and the ancients would not have defined tyranny in terms of the existence of power or the accumulation of it, but in terms of the objects to which that power is directed, and ultimately the condition of the soul. In the Politics, Book 5, Chapter 10, he defines a tyrant, quote, as has often been repeated, has no regard to any public interest, except as conducive to his private ends. His aim is pleasure, wherefore also in their desires they differ. The tyrant is desirous of riches, the king of what brings honor, and the guards of a king are citizens, but of a tyrant mercenaries, end quote. In the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle also reminds us that, quote, it is only in the Spartan state that the legislators have made provision for education and the guidance of life. In most countries, these matters are neglected, and everyone lives as he likes, ruling his own wife and children like the Cyclops, end quote. When considering the choice of pseudonyms, the choice of Publius is not only to be thought of with respect to Caesar, but even more importantly, I believe, to Solon and Lycurgus. In the definition of Publius, Lycurgus would certainly be a tyrant, but in the ancient understanding, he was the ultimate anti-tyrant. The remark that a modern commentator, a historian, has made about Solon captures, I believe, the entire spirit of the Federalist Papers, as well as Smithian political economy. He says that Solon, though he's been called the greatest economist of antiquity, did not really know much about political economy. For to his simple mind, it seemed that the source of the trouble was not the system, but greed and injustice. End quote. The motor for the new science of politics is greed and avarice. Precisely those characteristics which for the ancients described the soul of the tyrant. In Federalist 12, we find, quote, "The prosperity of commerce is now perceived and acknowledged by all enlightened statesmen to be the most useful as well as the most productive source of national wealth, and has accordingly become a primary object of their political cares. By multiplying the means of gratification, by promoting the introduction and circulation of the precious metals, those darling objects of human avarice and enterprise, it serves to vivify and invigorate the channels of industry and to make them flow with greater activity and copiousness. In brief, man is a monster more complicated and swollen with passion than Typho. Even though he cannot be reformed, he can be harnessed. The expected fruits of such harnessing are, we should never forget, liberty and charity." In Plutarch's treatment of Publius Valerius Poplicola and the comparison to Solon's life, he reminds us that Poplicola's riches were not only justly his, but he spent them nobly in doing good to the distressed. The incredible productivity of a free economy and the alleviation of man's distress were certainly promised fruits of the new science of politics, which have been delivered. To use a different analogy, one can compare the Constitution to a gigantic windmill, which is able to capture the winds of hurricane force and use that energy to grind the mills and produce bread for the people. One can make a very persuasive case that the modern liberals, who would subvert the Constitution in the name of equality, will end up killing the goose which lays the golden egg. Liberty is justified not only by itself, but also because it delivers the goods, and through economic growth, and effectively eliminates poverty defined in terms of any meaningful objective definition. It is presumably these indirect consequences of the Constitution to which Publius is referring in Federalist 1 when he refers to philanthropy and the public good. Let us also remember that the windmill, although thought of nostalgically today as belonging to the old order, was a symbol of energy and efficiency, in short of modernity, in that earlier commercial republic, Holland. But can we live by bread alone? Will not too much bread and material goods corrupt the necessary minimum of virtues that a commercial society presupposes? We have had the bread. All the founding fathers, Madison, Jefferson, Adams, Washington included, believed that there was a necessary minimum of republican virtue required for a free and responsible society. Irving Kristol has properly identified that virtue as public spiritedness. Pre-Claudian Roman, not very elevated, and essentially similar to what we would call the bourgeois ethic. They are, in essence, the virtues that the classical economists praised and thought would be the fruits of a middle-class society: thrift, hard work, spirit of independence, and self-respect. This is why they wished to destroy the vestiges of feudalism and hoped that material progress would be steady, but never in huge jumps, because unexpected riches and wealth may corrupt and produce sloth and decay. Now that we live in post-Republican times, hopefully not Caligulan yet, what can we do? To what standards can we repair? If I understand Diamond correctly, he does not give much hope from the Founding Fathers. There is a price or a trade-off which we have paid and which must be paid if one is to maintain a regime of liberty. He says we can go back and soberly think with the same seriousness as the Founding Fathers did, and that no one since that time has done, until maybe recently. But what the outcome of that process would be is left obscure by Diamond. There is the Heartland thesis that the people out there are still virtuous, as they may have been presupposed by the Federalist writers. On this hypothesis, all we have to do is to energize the sleeping giant and awaken him to his strength. Alas, one may also have to energize him to his virtue. In moments of despair, one gets the feeling that Kendall's missing chapter in The Federalist, which is to be filled by Richard Weaver, is much the same kind of enterprise as the missing link in evolutionary theory. Closely allied to this is the hope that the other American political tradition, the older anti-federalist, possibly Southern, what Richard Weaver has described as Apollinean as opposed to the Northern Faustian view, can fill the breach. The argument here usually invokes the idea that the Federalist and its presuppositions are usually restricted to the Union as a whole and does not prescribe what is appropriate for the state and local governments. Let me again quote Irving Kristol, who has stated this as a premise of the American political tradition. He says, "You can only achieve mild government if you have a solid bedrock of local self-government, so that the responsibilities of national government are limited in scope." And a corollary of this premise is that such a bedrock of local self-government can only be achieved by a people who, through the shaping influence of religion, education, and their own daily experience, are capable of governing themselves in those small and petty matters which are the stuff of local politics, end quotes. It appears to me that I think this is the view of Kendall, Kristol, Burns, and others, that however open in theory American society may be, the local and state authorities, along with cooperating social institutions, will have to be the repositories of virtue and piety. I am frankly in intellectual agreement that in this country we have that constitutional framework and an historical tradition to draw on and build upon when we need to. But I also take the view, which I would guess to be that of Gerhard Niemeyer's, that all the institutions and traditions will not help if there's not substance. The substance comes only from exemplary models of human character and goodness, such as Socrates and Christ. Roman republicanism is not enough. Conservatives are called upon not only to be bright and clever, witty and well-read, but the infinitely more difficult task of aspiring to be authorities, exemplary models of goodness and virtue. Now, the price we have to pay for this is a willingness to accept Socrates' alternative to the Federalists, and the early political economist's view of human nature, namely that we might be creatures of a gentler and simpler sort, possessing by divine grace a nature devoid of pride. We may have to forego our cynicism, our self-sufficiency, our hard certainties, our self-made men, and be willing to accept God's grace and what it entails. This is the task of all fathers, founding or not. Thank you.